Feels like it's ramped up a bit, Gareth. And Tim, I called it the phony war earlier. It feels like we really are getting into the curtain raiser for election campaigning now. And one of the steps for that this weekend was Labor's Congress and then National, of course, as you do, making sure it has got an announcement to really crash that party. So our commentators today are Gareth Hughes, who's a former Green MP, now works for the Wellbeing Economy Alliance Aotearoa and is no longer a member of any political party. Tim Hurdle is a former National Senior Advisor. He was the National Party Campaign Director in 2020. He's a director of several companies, including Museum Street Strategies, a public affairs firm. So the Congress, election, as it's called, the party conference, Labor's party conference in election year, part of the issue, Gareth, was you've just had a budget and you've just spent a bunch of money and you're trying not to spend so much money, so what do you do at your Congress? What did you make of it? Was there anything in it that rang of it's election year and here we are?
Oh, it was your traditional election, sort of whipping up the troops and getting them inspired and giving them the training. So I wonder if it was a bit of a misstep having it so close to the budget. They could have maybe stretched it out a bit and then had something to announce. Obviously what Labor did do was relentlessly focus on National. I mean, you could almost call it the National Conference because the focus was on National, and then sort of the media was gazumped by National's U-turn on the housing accord. A very different Labor Party conference to previous years. You know, previously we've seen celebrities on stage. This year we saw Mr. Whippy and Chris Hipkins handing out ice creams.
Rolls and
And so, I mean, it looked good on the news, but I wonder, there was not much news making generated at the conference. So if you weren't watching the TV news, you might have actually missed it.
That going negative this early is really interesting. I can recall party conferences, particularly when oppositions weren't doing well or had new leaders, where you would get former leaders like Clark just refusing to name, even mention or name their main political opponent. But that suggests there is an awareness of how tight this race is and the real threat to them, and they're obviously making the call they've got to attack, National in particular.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting insight, Catherine. I mean, historically, Grant Robertson was more of the attack dog, sort of the bad cop, but we saw a lineup of bad cops, ministers attacking Labor. We saw Mark Dowler do some analyses of the speeches, 25 mention of cuts, so on National. So very, this is the message that Labor's trying to push out there. You can't trust them. And maybe this actually falls to more Hipkins' safe zone. He's a very different politician to Jacinda Ardern, very pragmatic, quite a tough politician. So I think, you know, he's quite up for the fight.
And maybe it's what you've got to do if you haven't got a lot more to announce. You need to focus on what they are announcing and try and try and take it down. What did you make of it, Tim?
I thought they were trying to frame up the election, set up their themes for the election. I was surprised how quickly National took debate over super and got into that scrap. It's a very complex scrap, and I think they probably left it. I was very surprised with the apprenticeship boost policy, sort of really smacked of reinforcing failure. I wouldn't have thought that Hipkins wanted to talk about reform of vocational education and the apprenticeship boost scheme, which is pretty much a bailout of that failed policy. So I was kind of very surprised they went there. So they had a bad day on that front. But they are trying to get some momentum, get some energy into the troops. It's going to be a very different election. Last election, they wouldn't even talk about the National Party or their policies. This election, they're obviously just going to have a classic good old smack and try and put the fear of change campaign in place.
Well, let's look at some of that. So super was laid as a trap, basically, right? And this is interesting. When a party wants to stick to its core principles or whether it wants to do the politics of the moment, I suppose that was National's option, right? Were they just caught out? Are they just going to stick to their principles? What did you make of that suddenly becoming a headline?
Yeah, it's such a complex debate, super, and we seem to get fixated on a potential policy decision in 2024 and what, 2 years of age. We don't ever look at things like universality. I was reading up yesterday and the super fund starts paying out 2035, so that happens even before these supposed changes to the age are.
But it's that headline, and it's a headline to a certain demographic who just thinks, don't touch my super, even though it's not the demographic who's going to have their super touched, right?
I assume that the National Party strategy is to sort of try and focus on fiscal responsibility and say that the books are out of control and that we will take action. And that's probably why they're happy to talk about the super age changing, to actually say there's some reality going to have to come into the books given the fiscal situation.
But it's just not credible when they're also pitching tax cuts, which we know from the CTU research it would have blown out by more than $1 billion. So I think National sort of fell into the trap, if you will, which Labor put up there on the stage, which is once again diving into the detail. And we saw that with the $5 prescriptions. You know, National didn't have to do it, and
just
it came off
it.
Unpopular. Mm. I mean, even the Retirement Commission says we should keep it at 65. It is a popular policy. Our universal superannuation scheme means it's a lot more affordable than many other countries. So I think National fell into the trap.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. But I think there's some really big issues that this country doesn't really talk about in the super. We've sort of fallen in to a consensus, but the fiscal affordability of that scheme is going to be a long debate. And we tend to kick the ball down the road with super. We don't necessarily address it. And I guess that's going to come
it's
up.
Another complication here, but it's getting way back in history given what's happened in recent years, and that's what the Cullen Fund was supposed to be about. It was supposed to top up. You talk about it paying down from 2035, I thought it was around 2040. That's when the retirement population actually peaks, boomers and a few Gen Xs, right? And that was supposed to top up, but of course it fell off the pace because the position was you don't put money into a super fund at the same time you're running deficits. So, but who's up for that pointy-headed conversation? It's that simple messaging that this will now be refined down to. You mentioned the tax policy, and this was the story before we sort of got into a rush of stories at the end of the weekend, the CTU having done the numbers. And National, I don't know if they entirely agree with the numbers, but they certainly conceded that that it's blown out because of inflation. Is that going to matter? Have they got their line in the ground now, and they have to hold it with tax cuts?
I think they have to keep the faith with that, because they went with that policy very early on. They now are 20 weeks out. They can't really go making massive changes.
Is this the bracket change, the bracket creep adjustments,
yes, it is.
Right? So some other potential tax breaks or tax cuts got taken off the table, or at least they took the option of taking them off the table.
Yeah.
But even doing this is costing.
Yeah, and if you have a look at the fiscals released in the budget last week, there's some really weak fiscal numbers. The surplus out years are very low. There's still massive cash deficits, and we've got quite an expansionary policy. So there isn't a lot of headroom to spend. So that is pretty deliberately pushing National into having to talk about how they're going to tighten up the fiscal situation. I suspect whoever gets elected after the election will have that same problem.
But it opens up the important question, how are they going to pay for it, and what are their numbers, which they're saying they'll reveal maybe a month before the election or a little bit later than that. But it really opens up to this accusation from Grant Robertson in particular, this Bermuda Triangle of low tax, low debt, yet increased economic growth.
He's put some very big operational allowances in those books. He's got some very loose baseline projections, and these are very big numbers. We're talking $150 billion. So tightening up the fiscals can be a matter of actually looking at where the baselines run, where the money's been allocated, and getting into the fact that we spent a lot of money on emergency spending for COVID. So there must be policies and plans in there that need to be tidied up. You've seen things like the apprenticeship boost get funded to $480 million. So there clearly is money marked in the books that have been put into certain allocations. So there is a question of getting in behind the books and really finding out where the money can be.
And Nicola Willis tried her best in the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee to really try and get Adrian Orr to concede that. But actually what he said was, you know, we're contractionary in out years. There's a small expansionary impulse currently, but over the long term it's contractionary. So, you know, it was actually grist for the mill for Labor, and actually sort of a tick of approval for the budget.
On the inflation front, but not on the GDP growth front in ergo tax receipts and ergo spending. But again, we're at that point, not only in an election cycle, but in a government cycles, where people potentially can hear they spend too much money, but we're going to give you tax cuts. And actually the pressure that households are under right now means, la, 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 I actually just need some more cash in hand. So Labor probably needs to be careful about thinking it can point out this irreconcilable two forces, because people may just hear what they want to hear on that front.
Yeah, that's right. And we saw that last night with the Kantar One News poll that said 52% of New Zealanders wanted tax cuts.
Straight up the middle.
Straight up the middle. And, you know, 35% no. I think it was a poor question, the way it was phrased. I mean, I'd love a tax cut too, but I also love social services and want to see, you know, disadvantaged Kiwis looked after as well. I think the challenge for Labor is clearly it's got to do something in this space. We've got this tax report from David Parker. You know, there is some space on the other end of the tax system as well.
Yeah, but
I think Labor's got a problem, though, in that I think people are getting sick of the fact that they come out, promise a lot of money for a project or a policy and never deliver it. And I think that's part of the problem in the polls. Hipkins came in and said, I'm going to change things, I'm going to go back to basics. But he's got a problem that hasn't delivered anything. And I think people are now getting to the point of saying, well, if you're going to spend all this money and we get nothing for it, I'd rather have it back in my hip pocket and because times are tight and I've got things to pay for, I've got bills to pay. And I would rather have that money go into my business or into my mortgage than going into another government program which I never see the benefit from.
And I think this is what we're going to see for the next
this
5 months.
This is going to be the campaign.
Yeah, and, you know, it's all going to be down to who do people trust and the credibility of the messenger, because National's going to say Labor's addicted to spending, Labor's going to say National's addicted to cuts. Labor's, you know, spending is too high, yet Labor's going to point out it's going towards the 50-year average. National's going to say the debt's too high, Labor's going to say it's very low compared to other countries, and we're probably going to hear these messages ad nauseum over the next 5 months.
But that's where the personal circumstance in this election, perhaps more than for many, the personal circumstances and the personal messaging is really going to register with people, because they are hurting. There's another dynamic here that we'll get to now, which is that I cannot think of an election where both the major parties are polling mid-30s pretty comfortably, and yet both the smaller parties to their flanks are polling so strongly. Greens have taken a smack in this one poll, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. It's very rare. Normally you'll see, if you've got two strong, bigger parties, you'll see the smaller parties condense away to worry about the 5% threshold. This election's very unusual. So that brings us to the second part of this discussion, which is who is going to be pulling the strings in either government. And we've got, what have we got? We've got the Coalition of Chaos and the Coalition of Cuts. What is your observation of that? It is very tight from a poll of polls, and with both major parties needing pretty strong numbers from their potential partners.
Yeah, I think what you're not seeing, though, in those polls is accurate recovery on the undecided vote. And that is what is the major factor now. We're getting into the point where the people who haven't got time to worry about politics are having to focus on what's going on and make that choice. I think you're seeing the traditional left and right spheres blocking in and blocking up, and they're pretty evenly matched. And now it's the contest for the middle, and that's why you'll start seeing the leaders starting to move towards the centre, really start thinking about how do they connect with those groups, because these are the people they're going to have to win. And it comes back to some of those trade-offs that Gareth was articulating before, but those are the things that are going to determine the election. And the person, the party that can get the most movement when that centre ground will really start to shift the dial and start to get the momentum. And that's what those parties are looking to do, try and create some momentum and some direction and try and win them over.
Where does that leave National? It has been criticised of being of fighting too much in ACT's playground. And will it start to leave that alone now? It will probably be uncomfortable about the size of ACT's vote vis-a-vis its own, because this isn't going to be a case of here's our government with a few MPs on the side, and certainly not with a leader as competent and organised as David Seymour. Mm. So what strategically will National be thinking about where it focuses its messaging from here?
Well, if you look at that tour that he's undertaking, he started off in Auckland. He's doing a lot of marginal rural seats, which is probably right about now, trying to create momentum. But you're going to increasingly see the battle fought in Auckland. That's where the votes are, and in some of those urban areas and in those sort of large cities like the Palmerston North and Hamilton, where the party votes are, because that's where the centre vote's going to be. They're going to have to get in there and really make the case to the swing voters. They're just going to have to work out where their time and resources are best spent. And if you do any analysis, you always end up looking at West Auckland, and you look at some of the fringe suburbs.
To your previous point, though, Kath, I mean, National should be performing better, and the right-wing bloc should be performing better just looking at the economic conditions. We see, you know, they're up three, the bloc, right bloc, in the last Kantar One News poll. The left bloc was down six, so clearly those votes aren't all flowing across to the right-wing bloc. But that's just one poll. When you look at the Herald's poll of polls, it aggregates all of them. In fact, Labour, Green, Te Pāti Māori have a 50% frequent chance of success, 25% hung parliament, and only 25% National ACT. So while maybe the leadership speculations could be stymied by this last Kantar poll, we still see it's just not connecting with the public.
But we haven't zeroed in yet on what will be the other attack line, which is the coalition of chaos and the fact that Labour may need two partners and two partners who have pretty strong ambitions. It depends how that is perceived and that idea of who's going to be pulling the strings. We know we're near seeing that line being maxed out, right?
Well, that's true, but on the other side of the spectrum, we still see ACT and National taking pot shots at each other. We still haven't seen how they're going to work together in a government. And I think there's quite a fruitful attack line for Labour as well. Just how far will ACT twist National's arm behind their back, and what sort of far out extreme neoliberal policies are they going to sort of enforce on the country? That'll be Labour's attack line.
How far will National go saying Te Pāti Māori has this set of policies, Greens have this set of policies, Labour's dependent on them both, this is what it's going to, you know, how far will they go on attack?
Well, that's a tactical question as to how far you want to go after the minorities. Part of the problem with attacking the Green Party, if you're the National Party, you tend to drive them up in the poll and not pick any votes up. Those votes go off to the Labour Party. I would hope that the National Party is very focused on making the case for the centre ground and attacking the credibility of our third-term Labour government and the fact that the interest rates are starting to roll off and people are starting to really feel economic pain out in the country. Anybody you talk to has some anecdotal evidence of people getting really in trouble, paying their GST payments, finishing getting employment or meeting the bills of the week.
That's an important point also because there's a perceived sigh of relief for the finance minister with what the Reserve Bank governor said last week, which is this one was borderline, but we are doing another 25 basis points, but we see that as the end. But it will be a while till interest rates come down. Now, that's a message, but that pain in the pocket of so many people continues way past the election. In fact, for many, it will become a new pain because, as we were talking about with our banker last week, half of the mortgages are still to roll off. They're still to have this big hike. So again, when you're coming back to mood, it's not, you know, it is going to be very challenging for the incumbent on that economic front.
Yeah, absolutely. And but there's still solid fundamentals that Labour can point to, and that's what, you know, Robertson will be saying, low unemployment, you know, we're avoiding a recession according to the Reserve Bank, most likely now. Might feel like a recession for many Kiwis, but technically it looks like we'll avoid it. So that's the battleground it'll be fought on.
Let's talk about the Greens and what happened in that one poll. As we said, we always have to be careful of one poll. We don't like having as fewer number of polls as we do these days because you must look at trends. That said, either it's a rogue or that was a real smack. It was 4 percentage points in one poll. That's way beyond margin of error stuff. What happened in your view?
Oh, well, I think it's not a surprise, to be honest. And when you look at the Greens polling this year, it's been hugely variable. They've gone everywhere from 5.7 up to 12 and everywhere in between. So huge volatility, which I can't quite put my finger on, but clearly something significant has happened for it to drop 4%. You know, they've lost one of their caucus members for the last couple of months. Most of the message that the public have been seeing from the Greens is the Greens focused on themselves, you know, internal issues, very introspective. They've been going through list ranking when all the MPs are competing against themselves rather than other parties. So look, I think the voters don't like disunity, and the voters want to see parties focused on the issues rather than themselves. And I think the Greens have given that appearance the last month or so.
So just thinking, if we're very crude about it, did those votes go across to Labour? Did they disappear into the undecideds? There was no bump for Labour in this, do we? So what one could infer is maybe Labour lost some across the aisle and picked up some from the Greens. That would be your crude inference, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there could be a bit of wash happening. I mean, I think Labour's ECE policy, you know, would be quite appealing to a number of Green voters, particularly young women starting out with families or a newborn in the house, so maybe some of those votes have gone back to Labour. But when you also look at, you know, the bread and butter issues for the Greens, climate change, we have seen a number of climate policies thrown on the Chris Hipkins policy bonfire. What policies have come out have been more targeted to the big end of town. Like the steel smelter is a positive development, but for a, you know, a person struggling with their power bills, you know, how's it helping them?
How does that add up? Yeah. Okay. Well, let's come back from a microscope that was probably too close on one poll. Tim, when is it that you, as like put your campaign kind of manager hat on from 2020, when is it that you look to get evidence of a real mood shift? It's interesting in election campaigns, the polls can really tune for the first 2 or 3 weeks. Last week, typically, you start to get a clear picture, and particularly if it's going to break one way or another. With your crystal ball in front of you now, when are you really looking to see? Or is it the case that different demographics are potentially already ensconced and there's a comparatively small number of people who are going to make this happen one way or the other?
Well, you're normally working on a sort of ratio that a third of people aren't decided until the last month. And those are the hardest people to track. They're the hardest people to get to. A lot of people are actually genuinely too busy to be bothered with it, and these are the people that you're trying to get to. And so this is where the campaign matters, and this is where the momentum matters. What you're trying to do before the campaign is trying to create a sense of confidence and enthusiasm amongst your own supporters so that they're putting the messages out to the to those in the smoko rooms and in the classrooms and in the tea rooms to people. I think we're not going to see with this race until very late any sort of break, because I think those undecided votes...
How big is the undecided vote at the moment?
Well, some polls, I haven't been able to dig into it. I heard they were talking 12% on the Kantar, but I would pick it's larger than that.
Yeah.
That doesn't read with me. And it depends also, when we talk about polling to get that, often they do what they call probe, so they keep asking you to come up with a preference, and you have to provide
An answer.
And those people actually are often just sort of going with a vibe. Mm. So it's very hard to tell. Mm. But I would pick 25 to 30% of the population are thinking, especially at the moment, you can see that with the major parties, no one's got any great momentum or advantage at the moment.
Other thing I wanted to point out was Hipkins' sort of honeymoon has clearly levelled off, right? And he's still well ahead of where Christopher Luxon is. I know that remains an ongoing conversation, his personal popularity, Luxon's. But that rise has certainly levelled off, and indeed the party vote coming back in this a little. And so Labour will be nervous now as to whether there's a stabilisation or indication of further movement.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that, I mean, Hipkins dropped, I think, 2 points to 25. Luxon was up one, I think, to 18. So we're seeing both leaders actually following their party's votes. But I think Labour will be quite heartened, because they were, remember, late last year, early this year, polling at 25%, and I think one or two polls. So he's really brought a lot of stability to the vote. So Labour's hovering at that 33 to 36%, which gives them a good shot at forming a government, keeps it a tight election, which is the narrative, you know, they'll want to see. They need the Greens to sort of up the other side of the ledger as well. So Hipkins has brought stability, and it was sort of a slow drift towards electoral oblivion.
Mm.
Or at least losing the election, if that's too much of an exaggeration. But he's steadied the ship and made it very competitive.
Yeah, I just feel he's run out of momentum. That he's now going to have to find a second win, because I think he was given the benefit of the doubt, and I'm not sure that the public's been convinced that he's got the goods to go to the next term. So he's going to have to really pick up his game.
It's a long... what are we up to? 5 months? 4.5 months? 4 months. Let's say 4 months to the start of the election campaign. And I know all 4 months are the exact same number of days, but it feels like it's going to be a very long 4 months. It's kind of the mood, as much as anything, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, people are tired. We've had COVID, we've had economic challenges, you know, we've had years of it now, international uncertainty.
And I don't think, just speaking anecdotally, and your focus grouping or whatever would be interested to know, I don't think I've ever heard so many people saying, I've got no idea what I'm going to do, and I'm not very... enthused about either or any option. There's a lot of that anecdotally, which comes back to your undecideds.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Gareth Hughes and Tim Hurdle.